Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
Thank you for joining us for episode 50 of Pepperdine People. I'm Joel Fetzer, and I'm joined today by Sonia Nosario, the author of Enrique's Journey, the Pulitzer Prize-winning story about an Honduran boy's arduous trip to rejoin his immigrant mother in North Carolina. Ms. Nosario specializes in social reporting, most recently with the LA Times. So to begin, I was wondering, what do you think is the most important thing that you hope ordinary Americans learn from reading your book, Enrique's Journey?
I think what I've seen across the country, especially the book has been very popular as a freshman or all-campus read, is that many students tell me that they were raised racist and anti-immigrant, and that the book really humanizes immigrants. It takes you inside one immigrant family, and you understand through that family why people are leaving these countries, what they're willing to do to get here, and who our new neighbors are. I was just in Nebraska over the last 2 days, and, you know, in a rural area where suddenly a lot of people have shown up who are Latino and immigrant, and people are freaking out over this around the country where there have been these surges of immigrants arriving. And so I think it just takes you inside one family, and it puts a face on an immigrant.
Okay, I was also wondering, your book documents that ordinary Mexicans in Chiapas State were hostile to Central American migrants, but that many Mexicans in Veracruz or maybe Oaxaca State were generous to the point of engaging in civil disobedience on behalf of migrants. It was almost like a kind of, they surrounded the police headquarters and sort of resisted these anti-immigrant actions of the police. And they, even though they seemed desperately poor by American standards, they would give food to migrants as they crossed through in the trains. And I'm wondering what you think explains this difference in attitude. So was it simply that the Catholic leaders in Veracruz told parishioners to help migrants, or do you think that ordinary people in Veracruz would have helped Central Americans anyway?
I think there is a stronger religious element in Veracruz. That's where the missionaries first arrived. And so there's a much stronger influence in Veracruz of that. And I think many people from Veracruz had people leave their families and go to the United States. And they had seen the difficulties that people in their own families had encountered migrating. And so they really understood the plight of immigrants. But I think also, you know, people in Veracruz were more friendly than at the beginning or end of the journey in Mexico along the borders, because there were fewer gangsters. The gangsters who had arrived from Central America to Mexico would congregate in areas where people were either beginning or ending their journey, especially beginning in Chiapas in southern Mexico, because that's when the migrants had a lot of money on them, and so that's when they could best rob them. And so in Veracruz, there were fewer gangsters. They tend to kind of pollute people's view of immigrants, and you had less of that in Veracruz. So there were a variety of reasons why people were more open to immigrants, but I saw an incredible level of a willingness to give and protect migrants, even if, you know, facing actions by the police to do so, giving the little that they had to these total strangers coming from other lands. And what really drove people was their Christian faith and their belief that this was the right thing to do, and this is what Jesus would do if he were standing in my shoes. He would give to this poor person who's just trying to make it onto the next place. That Jesus was a migrant, and we should behave in this way. And that's what really drove a lot of these people.
I don't know the religious demography of Veracruz. Was there a difference between evangelicals and so sort of Protestants and Catholicos that you found?
It was largely Catholic, but there is a growing evangelical presence in Central America and Mexico, and has really been growing at the expense of the Catholic Church.
The other thing I was wondering about is, how do you think your reporting on Enrique and his family has changed their experience as immigrants? So because you reported on them, are they sort of still typical in some sense, or are they kind of like superstars in a certain way? So if you had never met Enrique, how do you think his life would have been different?
Their lives have really not been influenced very much by the reporting, because their last names are not used in the book, and that was meant to protect them in the sense that they were willing to tell their story to me and take that risk. But I didn't feel that, because they had cooperated for weeks and weeks on end with me, they should be penalized for that and deported. And so I made the decision not to publish their last names. So they are largely anonymous, and I think Lourdes came kind of secretly with me to one college college talk mm-hmm. and address the group kind of secretly. Mm-hmm. But there's always that fear that they could be photographed mm-hmm. and as they look now and one photo on the internet and mm-hmm. not only they could be deported, but everyone who lives with them, around them, who didn't sign up for this gig. And so I think they've been, you know, very careful about that. Their immediate friends know that they are the story. I think it's led to some frustration. Like Lourdes would go into bookstores when the book had first come out and it would be in the front of the bookstore mm-hmm. and she wanted to shout mm-hmm. from the rooftops, you know, that's me. Mm-hmm. But I think there's enormous pride that they have, that their story has helped educate so many Americans about immigrants. So, but they can't really share that pride with a whole mm-hmm. lot of people and not put themselves in danger.
Mm-hmm. At least for now.
For now.
You seem to have a lot of sort of ambivalence in the book about the mother's choice and, you know, should they stay in Honduras or Central America and suffer poverty, almost absolute poverty in many cases, or go to the U.S. and earn more money but then be separated from their children, at least for the short term. So I'm wondering, do you think that immigration in some ways is ultimately destroying the family in places like Honduras or Central America?
I think it is destroying families. I mean, I reported something that really has – I had not seen get any attention, which is that these mothers come here by the millions. They've come, single mothers, and left their children behind, knowing that by doing so they could send money back, their kids could eat, and they could study. But by being separated – And they leave thinking that this will be a separation of 1 or 2 years, but it ends up being a separation typically, I found, of 5 to 10 years. And these children despair, and they finally set out to go and find their mothers. But when they finally reunify, they think it's going to be this joyous thing, and they're going to finally have the love that they wanted to have from that mother. But this resentment kind of comes up. And, you know, they say, you abandoned me. And they resent and walk up to the line of hating their moms for leaving them. And so it has all this social fallout in that, you know, you have these heavily conflicted homes then, and the boys go to try to find that love somewhere else with the gang, or the girls try to get out of these homes by getting pregnant with an older guy. So it is destroying families. These moms lose the very thing that's most important, which is the love of their children. And so I really advocate that we either need to find a way to keep more immigrant families at home together. That would be the ideal, because believe it or not, this comes as a shock to many students. Most people would rather live in their home countries, not in America, with everything they know and love. They don't want to have to leave if they don't have to. And so we should try to find a way to help through our foreign policy in a variety of ways to create jobs in these 4 or 5 nations that are sending 80% of the people who come here. Or we should have an immigration policy that allows people to migrate as families. And splitting families up has been disastrous and has all this social fallout.
Okay. Reading your book, I came away with the impression that the economic and social problems that are causing migration from Central America are almost impossible to solve given sort of current economic and political and social realities. I'm wondering, you know, do you see any hope for the future of this region? Or what, you know, 10, 20, 30 years from now, Central America, are we still going to be talking about the same thing?
Well, as someone who was writing about the wars in Central America, you know, nearly 30 years ago, I see enormous change. When I lived in Latin America in the 70s, Latin America was controlled largely by dictatorships and dictatorial rulers who had no problem killing their citizens, and there was really no rule of law in many, many countries. And now in Central America, many of those revolutionaries that the U.S. opposed are now in power. I mean, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua just was elected to his third term in office, and you see the same with El Salvador. The left is now in power, and I think some of those governments are trying to take small steps to redistributing the enormous concentration of wealth in those places. I think the greatest threat to those countries is corruption, is overpopulation, is the remaining concentration of power in a few families that own so much of the wealth in those places. And in places like Mexico, it's the concentration of industries, the monopolies of industries in just a few hands. I mean, there's one guy who owns the railroads and the telephone company combined. So I think you need to break up some of those monopolies and really attack the corruption. And then there's the whole issue of the drug cartels and the enormous violence that that has brought to those countries. But a lot of what those countries are facing are the fallout from those wars that the U.S. Played a big role in, and those wars that destroyed the economies of, you know, Nicaragua and El Salvador and Guatemala, and really forced so many people to migrate. And I think we need to remember that that was the largest precipitating factor in destroying the economies of these places. And I think they're slowly trying to crawl out of that.
Okay. And finally, I'm wondering, you as an individual, as a reporter, how do you make a decision between, on the one hand, doing reporting, doing field work that is morally important, professionally important, versus staying alive, not taking unnecessary risks?
I always think that staying alive is a good thing. I'm very clear from the beginning, from covering wars in Central America, that no story is worth dying over, and certainly you're not going to tell the story if you're dead. So I try to walk up to the line of inserting myself in the action so that I can make you feel like you're in the action. To my role in riding on top of these freight trains through all of Mexico was to make you feel like you're up there on top of that train, making that journey alongside this boy that I'm writing about, and writing those narrative scenes in a way that you feel like you've been plopped down right next to him, and you're feeling it in that intense way. And my goal is to grab you by the throat, take you on a ride, and educate you, and hopefully make you care enough to do something about this. And I'm willing to put myself to some degree at risk to do that. I built many safety nets into this ride. I'm not insane. I had this letter from the president of Mexico. It helped keep me out of jail 3 times. I had many near misses. I did have a case of post-traumatic stress when I got back. I had to go into therapy for 6 months to get rid of that. So it did affect me, but I felt that the risks I took were worth it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.